Chapter 6 is entitled Copyrights and Trademarks. Copyrights and trademarks are two forms of an area of law called intellectual property. Intellectual property is increasing in importance in what we now call the information age, really the age of the internet. Many of you probably work in jobs where your primary responsibility is dealing with information, whether that's writing news stories or public relations press releases or advertising copy. That's not stuff you can actually physically hold. You might be able to hold the sheet of paper that a letter is composed on, but you can't really hold the words. Okay? So intellectual property protects the property that we create in many ways, and many of those are very beneficial to the creator of the work. Okay? Intellectual property became important as an umbrella area in the information age. Okay? Here in the United States, we started out as an agrarian society where we bought and sold things like sugar and cotton and wheat, all right? So things that you could physically hold, all right? Today, we buy and sell and trade in information. And we need to protect that as much as we might protect a cotton shirt or a bag of flour. All right. So intellectual property is the blanket term, and it covers a whole bunch of different areas of law. We're going to focus on a handful of those in this chapter. And again, it's pretty new. It really started when we started trading more in information than we did in commodities like, you know, sugar, flour, bacon, whatever. Okay. The idea behind intellectual property is that the creator should have the right to control what happens to his or her creative works. And the law has provided some protection for that. The information, we might say, has been commodified, which is a fancy way of saying we treat information as a commodity, much like we would treat eggs or milk. Okay? We buy and trade it. And this area of law means to protect that. Okay? The different classes of information don't have a whole lot in common, except that they're all about commercial objectives. How the holder of the rights of the intellectual property can benefit from his or her creative work. Okay? Generally speaking, it is a grant by the government of exclusive or special rights in return for some public good. So it's a trade-off. It's a balancing act. The government provides us some protection to be able to make money off our creative works, and in return we give up some of our rights or modify them in some respect. Okay? And again, it's all about knowledge-based or information age work. We're no longer worried about protecting things like butter and eggs. We're worried about protecting data, information. Okay? Some of the areas of intellectual property that we'll be talking about. Copyright law. Copyright law exists to encourage production. If you wrote the great American novel and the government took it away from you and said they weren't going to let you benefit from it, you're unlikely to write another one, right? So the government wants to encourage the production of work, and as such it provides protection for copyrights, that is, rights within a creative work, certain kinds of creative work, and we'll talk more about that in a little bit. Disclosure of ideas is protected in patent law. If you create a widget, right, or the one we'll talk about that I like to use, my favorite example is the Post-it note, The idea is that we want to encourage there to be more inventions that build from previous inventions. So we encourage the disclosure idea of ideas in exchange for granting the patent holder exclusive rights to make money for a certain amount of time on his or her patented work. Okay, we'll talk a little bit more about patent at the end of this chapter. Consumers are also to be protected against being lied to. Trademarks and domain name laws are there to protect the consumer. When I buy that wonderful cola product that is in the red can with the fancy lettering on it, I get a Coke. I certainly don't want that other cola product because, well, Pepsi sucks. Okay, forgive me for those of you who like Pepsi, but when I buy a Coke, I expect it to taste like a Coke and not like a Pepsi or a Dr. Pepper or anything else. Trademark lets me be sure that when I buy that product, it meets my expectations about what that product should do. Domain name laws are the same way. When I go to McDonald's.com, generally speaking, the law has understood that I expect to see a certain kind of information there. In this case, of course, about Big Macs, Filet-O-Fish, Quarter Pounder French fries. Okay? So those laws are there to protect the consumer. And finally, the last area of law is to enforce promises of secrecy. We're not going to talk a lot about trade secrets, but they are based in contract law. The idea that the government takes some information from you and keeps it secret so that it can monitor things like the health or what have you of a product, right? The FDA, for example, protects those sort of trade secrets against other people going in and poaching the other person's intellectual property. Now, that said, we've also talked a little bit about trade secrets in Chapter 9, right? So there are several areas of law that protect the area of trade secrets. We're not going to spend a ton of time in this chapter, but we will spend a little bit. Okay, so those are the five kind of broad areas of intellectual property law that we'll be talking about. Intellectual property, again, is the protection for creators to benefit somehow from their creations. They can benefit from them through financial means, through other creative means, etc. Copyright, trademark, service mark, patents, trade secrets, domain names, all of those are in the broad umbrella topic of intellectual property. This is a long historic past. First existed in 1710 in a rule called the Statute of Anne, and it was a British Parliament Act that gave the rights to the creators of the work instead of simply to the printers. We remember back John Peter Zenger back in Chapter 2, where we talked about how, you know, Zenger was the Kinkos of his time, and he was held accountable for some of the things that he printed. Some of that same idea carries over into IP, intellectual property law. The creators are now accountable for what they create and not so much the printers, and that comes out of the Statute of Anne. Here in the United States, protection appears in the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8. Congress, and that's important, shall have the power to promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited time to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries. Congress is an important word. That means federal preemption. We remember back from Chapters 1 and 2 what federal preemption is. Federal preemption means that only the federal government may regulate in this area. So only the federal government may regulate patents and copyrights, because that is what is in Article 1 and Section 8. Okay, authors and inventors, that's copyright and patent. We'll talk more about that as we get deeper in. All right, here's an overview of copyright law. We're starting with copyright law because I would argue it's the one that most of you will run into the quickest. Many of you probably have created works that you want to protect, and this is some ideas on why it's important to protect them and how you can go about doing that. The copyright holder has the exclusive right to reproduce works, to create derivative works, and to distribute copies, perform, or display it. Let me give you an example. Let's say I say, to heck with this whole teaching gig, I'm going to become an opera star. Oh! And I write and produce Janelle's Best Opera, or Janelle's Famous Opera, whatever we want to call it. I am the copyright holder. Let's say that I write the music, I write the lyrics, I play the piano or whatever I would need to do to produce that. It is my intellectual property. I have an exclusive right. That means nobody else gets it. That's what exclusive means. To reproduce the work, so I can make as many copies of it as I would like in whatever form I would like. To create derivative works, so I can write a novel about my opera, or I could write a screenplay, or I could license someone else to do it. I can distribute the copies. I can perform it on a street corner or anywhere else, or display it. And all of those are my exclusive rights. And if someone does it without those things without my permission, it is an infringement, unless it is shown to be a fair use. Right? We're going to talk about the test for infringement and the test for fair use in a little bit. Okay? When the copyright expires, and eventually that will happen, although the time between creation and expiration is getting longer and longer and longer, the work falls into the public domain and anyone can use it. The rule of thumb is about 1923. If a work is published before 1923, it is probably in the public domain. So Shakespeare, for example, 60s, whatever it was. I can never remember the years he lived. That's all in the public domain because it is out of copyright. There weren't really very many copyright laws to protect Shakespeare, and certainly in any of it, even the ones that were, are long gone. Okay? Happy Birthday, however, still is copyrighted. Although they don't enforce the copyright very often on people singing it to their friends in restaurants. Okay. Let's talk about a few things about copyright. Copyright, again, has existed in the Constitution since it was ratified, all right, back in the 1780s and 90s. The very first law, though, that attempted to try to understand what copyright should protect is in the Copyright Act of 1909. There are a lot more before that. I'm kind of focusing on the major ones. What they tried to do in the 1909 Act was amend it. Of course, in 1909, we had no television, radio was in its infancy, all we had was books, magazines, newspapers, and a little bit of radio. We didn't have the internet, we didn't have really sound recordings, we didn't have any of that stuff. So the copyright law was amended many times to try to handle it. And finally, in 1976, they just threw it out, and they made a new law. It's called the Copyright Act of 1976. And in 1909, if you didn't put the C with the circle around it, the copyright notice, you gave up some of your rights. That is no longer the case. The major difference between the 1909 law and the 1976 law is the rights that owners were given. In the 1909 law, really the only thing an owner could do was make a copy of his or her work. In 1976, the law was changed to give intellectual property holders the right to exploit their works any way they wanted to, whether it's sell them, license them, derive them, use them, perform them, display them, reproduce them. All of those are rights that were given to copyright holders in the 1976 law. You no longer need the circle with the C with the circle around it. It's copyrighted even without, as we're going to find out, but many people put it on as a notice to other people that they know what their rights are. Okay? And again, copyright is strictly federal law. If I wrote on a final exam, according to state copyright law, blah, 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 that would be wrong because Congress has preempted the field. Only Congress may deal with copyright law. It's in the Constitution. Okay? So there's no such thing as state copyright law, even common law copyright law, as of January 1st, 1978. Okay? So Copyright Law Act of 1909 was the first big one, and really the one that's that we're operating under right now is the Copyright Act of 1976. Okay. Things that aren't protected. Y'all have watched a Western where John Wayne pushes his way into the bar, and there's that pretty lady at the bar with the fishnet stockings on, giggling and drinking her brandy, and there's bar stools, and the bartender behind the desk with the with the vest on, and he's polishing the glasses. That's stock in every Western. That's called a scene affair. All right? It is a scene or a movie that is stock to the scene or the play. All right? So things like grungy post-apocalyptic scenes and things like The Matrix, that's a scene affair. They cannot copyright that idea. All right? It's really more of an idea that's been set out. They can copyright their characters. All right? So Neo and Trinity are protected, but that grungy post-apocalyptic scenario is not. Okay? Same thing, for example, with Harry Potter. Harry Potter himself is copyrighted. Hogwarts is copyrighted. But the idea of a magic school for kids and maybe some of the areas of the magic school are not copyrighted. Okay? Those would be a scene affair. Other things that aren't copyrighted. Anything that is written by the U.S. federal government. So you can, if you'd like, I'm not sure why you would want to, you could copy all the opinions from the Supreme Court since the very beginning and publish them in your own book. And that would be your copyright in the page numbers and any commentary. You don't own the opinions any more than the federal government does, but the federal government does not claim a copyright. A lot of the pictures that are in your textbook, if you've got a newer edition of it, are owned by the government. And if it's owned by the government, we can use it. You cannot copyright August 15th. People tried, all right? You can copyright your calendar that has pictures for every month. I know you can make those at Kinko's where you have your mom's birthday in January and you have a picture of your mom's birthday party. You can copyright those pictures, but you cannot copyright, you know, January 10th as your mother's birthday or whatever. You cannot copyright 16 ounces in a pound or 12 inches in a foot. All of those are common measures, okay? People tried. You can't do it, all right? You cannot copyright works that have already passed in the public domain. Okay? There's a whole area of law called orphan works that I believe your book talks a little bit about, but we're not going to go there. Public domain works are not copyrightable. They're already there. You cannot copyright Shakespeare. Facts and history. If you write a book, for example, on the Civil War, you cannot copyright the fact that the Civil War took place between 1861 and 1865. You can copyright your book about the Civil War interpreting those facts, but you do not own the facts or the history. Okay. The case that upheld this, the Supreme Court case, is called Feist Publications versus Rural Telephone Service Company. Some guy tried to copyright the phone book. All right. The phone book is simply a list of facts. It is a person's name, their address, and the phone number. They are simply an alphabetic compilation of those facts. You cannot copyright it. Now, say, for example, instead, though, I wanted to compile a list of a directory of all woman-owned businesses in Fullerton. So say that the coffee shop and the hairstylist place and the salon and the fashion place and the nail place are all owned by women, and I compiled that information. I don't own the information, but I do own the idea of making a woman-owned business directory in Fullerton. Okay? So there's a difference between owning your ideas about facts and owning the facts themselves. You can't own the facts, but you can own your interpretation of those facts. The major tenets, again, of the 1976 law are as follows. Basic protection now extends author's lifetime plus 70 years. Okay? It used to be plus 50 years, but then Sonny Bono had a skiing accident, knocked himself into a tree and died, and they named a law after him. Mickey was going to pass into the public domain in 2003. Disney wasn't very happy about that. Okay? Disney was like, oh no, we have to protect Mickey and Donald and Tinkerbell and all those great characters. Sonny Bono was a very strong advocate of increased intellectual property laws, and so they named the Copyright Term Extension Act after him. It was challenged in court, and the Supreme Court upheld the extension in the case of Eldridge versus Ashcroft. Okay, so it's author's life plus 70 years. So if I walk out in front of a bus and get killed, any of my intellectual property exists from that day to 70 years. And I'm going to guess, if I was a betting girl, I would bet my paycheck that the copyright term extensions are going to extend. When Mickey starts to fall into the public domain again, Disney will put on its lobbying hat and we'll see another extension. I don't see it not happening, unless something, you know, that I'm not seeing happens. Okay? Other things. You don't have to publish it. You know, I have diaries that I wrote back in the fourth grade that are really pretty boring. You know, this morning I got up, went to school, had mac and cheese for lunch, came home. You know, nobody's seen those but me, and frankly, nobody really wants to. But those are still my intellectual property. If I wanted to publish those, you know, Diary of a Young Girl in Northern Wisconsin, I could do that. All right? They're copyrighted even without being published. And again, I have the exclusive right to do anything I want to with my work. So my fourth grade diary, if I wanted to, I could publish it. I could license somebody else to publish it. I could license somebody to write a play or a book or a screenplay or a musical around it. Those are all my creative rights. And those are all protected under the 1976 Act. Registration is no longer protected, or I'm sorry, no longer required to obtain protection. I don't have to register the work with the Copyright Office, but as you'll see, if I do, I have a whole lot more protection than if I don't. I always tell students, if you've got a great idea, you know, or you've written a poem or a song and you really want to be able to benefit if somebody else steals it, pay the small amount of money, go to copyright.gov and actually file the paperwork. You get so many more benefits from protecting work than if you don't. Okay? And again, there's no longer any state common law copyright. It's all federal. Okay? All right. Copyright protection extends to original works of authorship fixed in any tangible medium of expression, now known or later developed, from which they can be perceived, reproduced, or otherwise communicated, either directly or with the aid of a machine or device. Let's take that apart. Original. Well, that means you don't copy it from somebody else. It's got to be your original work. As we're going to see, the infringement rule, you know, provide some protection for those people who might have been infringed upon through copying. Okay? Fixed in any tangible medium. You cannot copyright an idea. It has to be set down in what we call fixed form. That means it is written down, it is recorded, it is, you know, scrawled on a piece of paper, it is set into a digital recording device, like I'm doing right now in front of my computer. It is typed into a Word document and saved. As long as it is in a fixed form, it can be protected. You cannot protect something that's floating around in your head. It's got to be in a tangible, touchable medium. But it doesn't have to be in a medium that we necessarily need, you know, can directly perceive. If I write a note to my husband, you know, on a sheet of paper, I can pick that sheet of paper up, and anyone can, and read the words directly. However, if I type him a note on my computer, I still need a computer to be able to read it. No matter how hard I stare at a CD, for example, I can't hear the music on it. No matter how hard I stare at my flash drive, I cannot look at the files on it. I need a machine, and that's okay. It really tries to keep up with the times. In other words, you know, now known or later developed, in other words, means that maybe in, you know, 2050 we'll have other storage devices that we wouldn't have thought about in, you know, in 2010. And those are still protected under the law. So it really tries to keep up with the times. directly or with the aid of a machine or device. Again, if it can be saved and reproduced in some way that I can see it or hear it or perceive it, that is okay. All right? So that is what copyright protection extends to, or what the law calls affixes to. All right. Again, you do not have to copyright. You don't have to register your work. As soon as you write that note to your sweetie, it is copyrighted. Nothing else has to be done. Now you're thinking, well, it would be my word against the other person's word, and you're right, which is why registration is important. Even though it exists immediately upon fixation, as soon as I record these words that I'm recording right now, it's my intellectual property. I own the rights. However, to be able to enforce those rights, it's probably a good idea to register. If you want to sue or defend against somebody infringing your work, you really should register. The Copyright Office is at copyright.gov. You pay a fee. You send them copies of your work, whether digital or otherwise, and they send you registration forms. Most of it can be done online now, and the fees are a little bit different. The description is in your book. You should also give notice. Like, for example, if I were concerned about somebody stealing these slides, I would have a copyright notice at the bottom. I don't do that because I know that my rights are protected and I'm not really trying to make money on these PowerPoints, all right? The copyright of the book is held jointly by me, Wayne Overbeck, and the publisher, all right? There's a copyright notice in your book, and there are copyright notices all over the place. What that notice does is it tells people that you know that you own those rights. So it's a notice to other people. And again, electronically, physically, there's a little bit of difference. The fees are a little bit lower if you do it electronically than if you mail in paper or other kinds of copies. If you're interested in this, copyright.gov will provide you all sorts of information. You can also copyright lots of small pieces together as a compilation. So I had a student, one of the first semesters I was teaching here, who was a songwriter, and he wanted to copyright all of his songs, but he had like 100 of them. And at the time, I think it was $30 for a single piece. Well, 30 times 100, that's $3,000. There is a way that you can gather all those together in a compilation and pay one fee. And all that information is available on the copyright.gov website. Okay? You are able to get damages. You can get statutory damages, even if the actual damages are not that high. Let me give you an example. Let's say that I go down to the local coffee shop where they have an open mic. And I take my guitar, and I sing my little song and poem, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And somebody in the office, or somebody in the audience, writes down my lyrics and my chord progression and goes and records my song. And let's say it makes $100 million. I have the right to get some money out of that. If I haven't registered, it's a little bit tough to defend it. But I would be able to get actual damages if I'm able to prove them. So I could maybe get $100 million. If I don't register it, it's going to be a little bit harder. Now, let's say somebody copies my song and makes $50 on it. I am still entitled to some of that money, and if I've registered, I can actually get more for willful infringement. It's called statutory damages. It is for small amounts of damages where you might not be willing to go to court. You can get damages even for small amounts of money, and those can be made higher if you register, right? So bottom line is, if you register your work, you are able to get more damages and you are able to exercise additional rights. So if you write something or create something that is important, go through the hassle of registering it. Okay? Statutory damages, again, are for arbitrary sums that are hard to prove. Okay? So you can get additional money even if, you know, you might not sue for $50. They basically give you additional damages for the hassle of it all.